The technologies that our guest has developed are playing an important role in changing the world, not like the car, the microwave, or the cell phone, but as in Doctors Phlox, McCoy, and Crusher. Modern medicine is about to change, and so will we. Coming up next on Futures in Biotech.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at cashfly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 93, Snyder's Omics.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today we have a very intense topic, and it's one of a paradigm shift. So I decided that it might be a good idea to bring on Andre Dantel as our subject matter expert in the area of genomics and systems biology. So welcome to the show, Andre.
Thanks, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here as always.
Boy, I'm glad you're here. This is going to be a big show. Our guest today published a historic paper less than 1 month ago describing the first comprehensive study of an individual combining genomic, transcriptomic, proteomic, metabolomic, and autoantibody profiles. The study was conducted over 14 months through healthy and disease states, over 3 billion measurements on a single individual, over 20 time points. This experiment is an important step towards ushering in the era of personalized medicine. Dr. Michael Snyder is the Asherman Professor and Chair of Genetics and the Director of the Center of Genomics and Personalized Medicine at Stanford School of Medicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Snyder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The past 30 years of molecular biology has really been in a reductionist era where the questions in science have been, what is the gene doing? What's its function? Right? I'd like to ask you, at what point, what was it like, and what was the at what time did you start seeing genetics from a comprehensive perspective?
Well, I think we've been moving this way for some time, but it's really come to a head, I'd say, in the last 10 years or so. With the advent of new DNA sequencing technologies, it's now possible to sequence the whole genome and know all of your genetic information at a detail that's never been known before. And with this sort of power, the hope is that you'd be able to ultimately predict what you might be at risk for in terms of diseases and health states and things like that.
But you were working on single genes, on cell polarity, on sort of as a cell biologist with genetic tools and yeast. And then you decided to flip the type of question and go with these, at the time, behemoths, these giant projects. I'd like you to, if you could tell us a little bit about your first, that first experiment where you said, well, I'm going to do every gene.
Oh, sure. No, that's right. I think certainly in the 70s and 80s, I entered science in the mid 70s and the mid and late 70s and then through the 80s. And people used to study one gene at a time. Maybe a whole lab would study a couple of genes. And I was part of that. I cloned a gene and characterized it, or a few genes, for my PhD. And then when I moved to Yale, which was now about 28 or so years ago, I realized that it was rather frustrating and rather limiting to be able to simply look at things one at a time. And so after a few years, we embarked on a project to essentially characterize all the yeast genes at once. And so that was quite a transition, and it was a very different way of thinking, and I think that's what launched us down this path And yeast was the perfect system for which to set up this technology because it's one in which you can manipulate the genome, analyze genes in large scale. The genome's a little bit smaller. It's it has 6,000 genes instead of 20,000 like people. So the whole thing was a lot more easy to deal with. And it was a great system in which to launch this. And we set up a lot of the methods that we ultimately used and later applied to humans. But this would then be in the late 80s. We launched this, and I think we published our first large-scale paper in 1994. It was even before DNA microarrays were coming to fruition. It's really what launched us into large-scale gene and protein analysis.
Was it the robotic? Go ahead, Andre.
So essentially, you've worked. I mean, I've known you mostly from your yeast work, and you started switching to, let's call them non-fungal organisms, a little bit after that. So, but right, you've moved in Stanford. Was it 3 years ago now? 2 years ago?
That's right, in the middle of 2009. So it's about 2 3/4 years ago.
And the study you published in Cell last month was, I think, your first big paper since you've moved to Stanford that was really stuff you started doing after you moved to California. And I think it was rather unique because up to now, there was a lot of genomics and post-genomic studies done on humans. Most of them were essentially doing a lot of measurements, but at a single point in time and looking at a lot of patients. And what I first heard of your research when you talked in Montreal at the, I think it's the American Society of Human Genetics or something like that, where essentially say, well, instead of looking at 100 patients at one point, we're going to look at one patient for a very, very long time. And if you can go and introduce a little bit how you decided to go with that study and made it the landmark that it is.
Yeah, sure. So for quite some time, we have been studying and working in the fields of both genomics, which is the analysis of genomes, as well as proteomics, which is the analysis of proteins. And we've been thinking for at least 10 years or so now that we need to actually be able to apply both of these to not only understanding human biology, but also really applying it to healthcare and medicine. And that was the driving force. And we've been working on this for some time. And we set up methods. In fact, our lab has been studying variation between yeast and humans, trying to understand how are people different from one another. And then it's a natural outcome to try and understand how people are different between healthy and disease states. And so I'd say what launched this study was a combination of two things. With the advent of genome sequencing, genomes were just starting to get sequenced, and we realized that this is going to be a really important part of healthcare. And yet it was controversial. Even when I first moved to Stanford, there were a lot of people who said, oh, we shouldn't be sequencing genomes. People are going to learn information. They don't know what it means. A lot of what they learn will be very harmful. They'll learn they have some disease they can't do anything about. And we had a very different view of this. We viewed that your genome sequence could be very valuable for implementing and incorporating into your healthcare. And so that was one aspect of this. And the other was just realizing that what goes on in medicine today is woefully inadequate. That is to say, when you go to a doctor's office, they give you a physical exam and all the obvious physical types of features, blood pressure, that sort of thing. But when they do a blood test and they draw blood, they measure usually about 15 things, maybe even less. And if you think about it, with today's technology and the ability to measure thousands, if not tens of thousands of things, that just seemed ridiculous to me. And so the idea that you should be both combining genomics as well as measuring thousands of things that would give you a much better perspective of what might be going on with your health seemed like a no-brainer. So the way we got started in me is that we knew we wanted to launch this, and the idea was to get a genome sequence to follow people's samples and follow everything, or at least as much as we could. And that meant your transcriptome, your RNA, your proteins, which are, you know, much closer to probably your phenotype and health state, and also your metabolites. And we're big believers that following your antibodies and your immune system is very, very important as well, because your immune system is a very sensitive measure of disease states. And so the idea was to study all of these things at once and really measure as many things as we could in the blood. We didn't know what was going to be important, and we still don't fully know what's going to be important out of this, but we're doing about 40,000 measurements from every sample we take.
Now we decided. The subject of that study is described as a 50-something Caucasian male in healthy Caucasian male. I think you can tell us who that is.
Oh yeah, of course that's me. So the obvious question is, why is it me? Well, we knew we wanted to get this going. Genome sequencing, as they say, when we started this in 2009, it was a little more controversial, with some people saying we shouldn't do this stuff, people like me believing this is going to be fundamental to healthcare in the future, that you'll be sitting down with your genome, your family history, and your medical exam and trying to really understand your health state.
So let's start with your genome sequence. I mean,
Back up. Why me? Should I finish that one part? Yeah. So why me? Well, we wanted to pick. There were two things in mind. One, we wanted to pick someone who was convenient, very easy to get lots of material from, because I've been many of these studies. You take enough sample, and you do a lot with it. You take more than you think you need, and suddenly you discover you're out of sample. So by choosing someone accessible, that would be very easy. And the other is, because it was controversial, there was this issue of, gee, what if we consent someone? They learn something they don't want to, even if we consent them, they may find something they don't want to know. They may get all upset. And so I knew I could pick someone who that wouldn't be a problem, who would consent and not come around and sue me or what have you. And it would just be very easy to deal with. And of course, then that meant it was me. And that's why we did it.
Let me interject here. Wouldn't it be also, you know, as the PI of this mega project, I guess somebody who wouldn't not just sue you, but somebody would decide, this isn't for me. This is too much information. I want to walk away from the project. Knowing who you are and how determined you are, I could see that picking you guarantees that your sample won't walk away and say, I'm done with this study, right?
Yeah, that's right, Mark. In fact, when you think about it, the idea was to profile me and follow me through time. And the most interesting times are when you're sick. So I have two little kids. I've now been profiling myself for a little bit over 2 years, and I've been through 4 viral infections because I have these kids who do get sick.
Right.
And and not every person is going to want to walk into lab, give up blood when they're not feeling well, whereas someone who's pretty committed to the project and committed to the study, and anyone who knows me, I'm here at the lab all the time, so I'm pretty easy to take samples from, whether I'm sick or healthy. You have to be pretty committed to do a project like this.
I guess there's only one person that would be committed is a PhD student who doesn't get the PhD unless they give blood.
No, that's right.
The ethics committee might object.
No, that's exactly right. I was going to say, I can't actually study anyone in my lab, because you'd be criticized for coercion. So there are people in my lab who really, really want to get their genome sequence, who really want to get these IPOP profiles, but I cannot work on them simply because it's a conflict of interest. I could be accused of coercion, etc. So unfortunately, those individuals I cannot study.
So what was the opinion of your family when you told them about the projects initially, and then during the project, did their opinion of the whole thing change?
Well, I guess by my family, you could say my brothers and sisters and mom. I don't know how much they really knew about it. I did keep my mom informed from time to time. And you probably know she ultimately participated in that. She got her genome sequenced, and we've also done one profile on her. She's very curious. And my family, they're very curious by nature, and I think they were quite fascinated by the whole thing, my brothers and sisters and mom. And then my immediate family, my wife and kids. My kids are quite a little, so they don't really follow what's going on. But my wife, she knows me pretty well, so she couldn't imagine me not doing this, I suppose. She knows I'm kind of a pretty diehard scientist, so.
So let's start with the genome sequence. I mean, yours was sequenced at a pretty deep level, like almost like 100-fold coverage. Usually a genome sequence is like 8 or 10-fold for a human. So what did you take up from your DNA sequence?
Well, same thing. These technologies were just emerging in 2009, and we wanted to go at it systematically. Which technology is the best? What are the strengths and weaknesses? I think a lot of people, even at that time, were thinking, oh, you just go get a genome sequence. And nothing can be further from the truth. The technologies, they're great, but they do have some deficiencies. There's a few percent of the genome that you don't follow. So what we wanted to do was dig in and take the leading technology. So we sequenced my genome with both Illumina platform and Complete Genomics. And we didn't publish this, but we also used Life Technologies platform at the time, Solid, which is not so prevalent. So we have the data. We've analyzed it a little bit, but it gradually sort of fell by the wayside. And then the other two technologies, we wanted to compare, see which was best. Everybody is doing Illumina, but we had reasons to think Complete might actually be pretty good, Complete Genomics. So we sequenced ridiculously deep and then compared them. And so it was partly just to figure out what technologies are the best, what are their limitations. And then at the end of it, of course, we came up with an incredibly accurate DNA sequence, which is very, very valuable, because when you're trying to do a medical or a clinical interpretation of a genome sequence, you actually want the most accurate sequence you can. You don't want to have lots of errors and say, oh, here's a variant that means this, and then you go test that, and down the road, you discover, well, that variant wasn't real after all. So by doing two different technologies, going very, very deep, including exome sequencing, we've done that with three different platforms as well, we started out with an incredibly robust sequence. And quite frankly, we're a believer that these days, if you want to do a clinical genome, you might actually do two different technologies, Complete and Illumina, because it saves you a lot of time and a lot of money than to just do one technology and spend all your time chasing the variants.
So what is when James Watson, one of the discoverers of the DNA sequence, had his genome sequence, he was very interested in the mutation that he had, but he specifically mentioned that he did not want to know about Alzheimer's predisposition genes because he's had family members who ended up with Alzheimer's. Did you go with the same philosophy in the middle, in the sense, I want to know everything except this, this, or that?
Well, I'm a believer. I go by the motto that more information is always better than less information. So I personally want to know everything, even if it's bad news. Now, I realize that's not for everyone. There are people who don't want to know if they have Huntington's or Parkinson's or what have you, where you can't do anything about it. And I certainly respect that. That's quite reasonable. But I tend to be the type of person who thinks I want to know the news, whether it's bad news or not, and I'll just deal with it. And I'm not a huge worrier by nature, so give me all the information and I'll just deal with it however it comes. And so that's how I live by. So I wanted to hear it all. And if I learned I had Huntington's or was at risk for Huntington's, that would so be it. I want to know that. And it's possible down the road we'll get very definitive about some nasty diseases that my genome says I have, and someone's probably going to discover that and let me know. And I welcome the information. I want to know it.
Are you common, though? Most people do want, I mean, most scientists want to know their genome. I would love to have it. I'd love to know what I have, if I have anything that can be determined by, you know, the versions of the genes that I have. But, you know, there's a tremendous fear out there in the population where, oh, that's, you know, somebody else could get hold of the information and do something cruel or evil with it. Insurance companies could drop insurance policies when they have, because they have new information.
If they do that, Mark, they won't have anybody to insure, because it turns out we all have dozens, if not hundreds, of mutations that inactivate proteins.
Well, that's the reality of it. But
right,
Dr. Snyder, what do you think?
Well, I'll weigh in on two aspects of this. The first is simply that there is the information. What do you want returned to you? And I recognize that's not for everyone. Some people may only want actionable information returned. That is to say, I'm at risk for breast cancer, and so be it. I'll therefore get tested a lot, or if I'm a woman, I'll have my breasts removed or what have you. So there are some people who only want actionable information returned to them. Some people don't even want, for example, the breast cancer risk mutations returned to them. I think that's a mistake, but that is their decision. So I think ultimately this should be worked out between the individual and their physician as to what sort of information they want returned. And that may vary with different people. And it's hard to know exactly where to draw that line, but I think that's what should be done. Then the second issue that you've raised, Mark, is what kind of discrimination can occur as a consequence of getting your genome sequenced. In the U.S., at least these days, you're not supposed to be discriminated for either health insurance or employment. Now, whether it happens informally can't be said, but at least by law, you're not allowed to be discriminated. That's a fairly recent law. But you can still be discriminated for life insurance and for long-term disability in the U.S., and that can happen. And so, and in my case, after I was diagnosed with, I'm probably getting ahead of ourselves, but I was diagnosed with diabetes. And as a consequence of this whole study, I argue that was good. I caught it because I caught it early and corrected. But after it was diagnosed and it showed up on my medical record, my life insurance, adding additional life insurance, that did skyrocket and made it prohibitive for me to get that. So,
Wow. It's amazing. You know, this raises a million questions. And one of my short little questions, which is a sidetrack and it's a technical sidetrack. How do those two technologies, DNA sequencing technologies, compare to the ion torrent technology? Because there's a number of competing. Just is ion torrent one of the, a trademark name of one of the ones you just mentioned?
It's a new technology that's come out since we did my genome. We're evaluating it now. Ion torrent is not so useful for sequencing a whole genome, but the successor of that, which will be coming out soon, Proton is, and we're in the process of evaluating that technology to see which one is best and what you can and cannot learn. One of the nice things is that these technologies are all different. And so the errors generated by one technology are different from the errors from another technology. And by therefore combining information from two different technologies, you get a much more accurate sequence. That's one of the lessons we learned along the way. And so maybe ion torrent will be a great dominant technology of the future. We're evaluating it, but I predict we'll still combine it with other, you know, one of the other leading platforms.
So what did you learn from your own genome?
Well, what I learned was that two things. At my first glance, I learned that I saw increased risk for two things I didn't expect. Well, let me back up. The very first thing I learned is I was at risk for things I kind of knew about. So atherosclerosis I'm at risk for, and since everyone on my father's side of the family has died of heart failure, pretty near everyone has, I kind of expected that. I also knew that I had high lipids and high cholesterol. I knew that from medical exams, and that showed up in my genome. And lastly, I knew I was at lower risk for obesity, which, again, nobody in my family was overweight. I suspected that. So those are the things I knew already that were confirmed. The things that were a surprise to me were I saw a mutation that said I should have aplastic anemia, if you read the literature. And it was a mutation in an enzyme called telomerase, which adds DNA on the ends of your chromosomes. So I measured the ends of my chromosomes, and they were not short. They were not damaged in any way. And we did this several different ways. They might have been a touch shorter, but there was nothing to worry about. And then we also sequenced my mom, and she had the same change, and she clearly didn't have the disease, nor do I. So at the end, I don't think that mutation always says you have a disease. So that's an example why you have to interpret this information cautiously. And then two other things I discovered I was at risk for. One is basal cell carcinoma, which I'm still keeping an eye on. I haven't seen anything along those lines yet. But the big surprise was I was at risk for type 2 diabetes, because that was not evident in my family or running in my family. And that was the first thing I learned out of my sequence. And that last information I did act on as well, aside from the telomerase one, which turned out to be a false alarm.
Was it the sequence or was it the transcriptome? What were the elements that gave you that information?
So that first information came out of my genome sequence. So that was one of the first things done. And in the meantime, I had been doing this, what we call whole omics profiling or personal omics profiling, at the various time points. And one of the things we were measuring, in fact, was my glucose levels. And it didn't matter whether I had been fasting, which is when you normally take glucose levels, or after a big lunch of cheeseburger and fries, my glucose levels were pretty normal, meaning they were 100 or less, even after eating a big meal. And because I had been doing this personal omics profiling, I was following this. But I did see in my genome that I was at risk for diabetes, so I signed up for a very fancy glucose metabolism test that's run out of Stanford. It took 5 months to get this test. It's run by an expert person named Jerry Reaven. His group runs this test, and I signed up for this thing to measure my glucose metabolism. And it's a pretty amusing story, because I went in there to get this test, and the woman looks at me and she says, "There's no way you have type 2 diabetes. You don't have a family history." I said, "There's no way I have type 2 diabetes, but my genome says I'm at higher risk for this. For something with glucose metabolism, I really want to see what's going on."
Was that before the viral infections?
Well, it turns out it was the first time point after the viral infection. And so what had happened was I went in for this test, and even before we started the test, she measures my glucose, and it's 127, which is pretty high, and certainly higher than anything I had seen. So she says, oh, something's wrong, so we repeat it, and it comes out the exact same number. And so we went ahead with the test, and I was not insulin resistant or some of the things that you worry about with diabetes. But in fact, I did go, that caused me to start following this even more intensely. So I did some follow-up tests. There's something called a hemoglobin A1C, which is a better measurement of glucose levels. And that came out really high, 6.4. And in the meantime, my glucose had shot up to 150. So this was now at a state where it was concerning. So I went to my general practitioner. I'm on a health plan, and because I didn't know much about diabetes and I wanted to learn more. So I went in there. I took me a little bit of time to get to the doctor because I'm a pretty busy guy. And I went in there, and she looked at me, and she says, by the way, I don't look like I have diabetes. I don't fit the normal type of person who gets diabetes. So she looked at me, and she said, there's no way you have diabetes. Those guys got the tests all wrong. So she repeats them, and of course, it turns out my glucose is quite high. It was 150. And my hemoglobin A1C hit 6.7, which classifies you as diabetic by a number of different groups. And so she says, oh, you're diabetic. So at that point, it was official. I was classified as diabetic, and I was then trying to learn everything I could about diabetes, which, again, I didn't know much about because it wasn't really running in my family. Shortly thereafter, I decided I have to change my diet. I had a really bad eating habits. I used to eat lots of sweets, candy, cakes, especially ice cream. And on April 13th of last year, I mean, I remember the date, I just went cold turkey. I cut out all that stuff. I now eat very, very healthy. I also increased my exercise. I've always biked to work some, but I made sure, rainy day or not, I still bike in. And so I've doubled my biking, and I started running. And it wasn't intentional, but my weight dropped about 15 pounds gradually. And gradually, my glucose levels came down. It took about 6 months, but November of last year, it finally came down to normal. So my glucose levels were very, very high for 2 months. And then after this rather rigorous change, things, they gradually came down to normal. That's kind of the glucose side of the story. And it did, as you point out, it turns out that my glucose levels shot up right after this nasty viral infection I had. So I've had now 4 viral infections as I've been profiling myself, 2 that were published in the study. And the first one was fairly mild, nothing particular happened. But the second one was quite nasty. I was out of work for 2 days. That's very unusual for me, for people who know me. It's called a respiratory syncytial virus. It's a nasty cold. People do get it. It's not as common as some of the others colds that are around, but I did get it, and it was right after that my glucose level shot up.
Let me ask a question here. I mean, and I have to put this in perspective, at least for my own sake here. From 37,000 feet, this looks like the first example, I guess one of the first examples where a genome was sequenced. And it made a prediction as to your personal health, and that prediction came true. So it's kind of as I mentioned in the intro here, it's kind of a new era of personalized genomics or personalized medicine. And this is a beautiful example where your genome said you had a precondition, or not a precondition, you had a predisposition towards diabetes, and then, triggered by RSV, all of a sudden your body goes under stress, and then it responds to the stress poorly, and then you develop higher glucose levels in your blood that take 6 months and an arduous trek to go back down. So do you see that as one of the first true transitions into personalized medicine? Because, I mean, I haven't been to the hospital where, I mean, they sequenced 10 of my genes when they were looking for a blood disorder, but it was not a genome. Is this a good example of how you see medicine moving?
Well, absolutely. In fact, I think that's one of the big points of the study. We think your genome can be valuable. And prior to our study, this was controversial. And even at the major meeting for the American Society for Human Genetics last year, everybody was saying, well, genome sequencing will someday be valuable as part of your healthcare, but we're not ready for it yet. There's not a whole lot you can learn from genome sequencing. I never believed that. Although we don't know everything, in fact, we don't know a lot, there are still some things we do know. And so I'm a believer that this information can be valuable. I didn't necessarily expect it to be so immediately valuable for me. That was quite a surprise. But I do believe that the future is you will sit down with your genome, your family history, and your medical exam, and in fact, that will be how your health state will be diagnosed and followed.
So, Dr. Snyder, when you already mentioned, so the paper mentions two cases of viral infections. You've now revealed there were two more since. Had the transcriptomics or the other studies you've done identified any cases where you caught something, but it ended up being as asymptomatic?
Well, in a sense, yes, perhaps. So in the RSV infection, we noticed that 2 weeks after the initial infection, there was a spike of activity of things going on. And now we don't know if that's something subsymptomatic that occurred or it's just an aftermath of the RSV infection that stimulated this. But we could see all kinds of glucose pathways going a little bit haywire. And what was interesting about that, that really only came about because of this whole molecular signature. We were doing the whole omics profiling, where we could see the transcriptome, proteome, and metabolome all changing in a very unusual way. And that, in fact, preceded the high glucose phenomenon, the onset of diabetes, if you will.
And have you noticed anything, let's call it more permanent, since you've changed your lifestyle?
Well, not in terms of my omics signature. We're still following that to see what changes may be more long-lasting, to be honest. And we haven't analyzed all of the latest data sets. So that is one pitfall with our study. It takes time to analyze these data and understand what they mean. So we collect these samples. We usually analyze them a number of them at a time, maybe six at a time. And then it takes us literally weeks, if not months, to pour over the data. Now, that's simply because this was the first time it's done. I think as we get better at this, as we analyze more people, I hope that ultimately this we can do this in real time. That is, you'll get one of these blood draws, you'll get it analyzed in a few hours and get the results back the same day or the next day. That would be the ultimate goal.
Let me ask you a question. We're both Andre and we're in the back chat. We have a chat going back and forth. We both are wanting to ask all these questions. We're dying to ask you the next question. It's my turn. So I'd like, if possible, because we have a lay audience, but generally a highly educated audience. And the idea of what omic signature, I mean, you coined the term, or coined it, probably it was you, right? I'm not sure. But you used it here. And what could you explain the omics? I mean, the genome's the easy one to understand. You take the DNA and you go base by base and compile a database. But what's a transcriptome? And how does that relate to a proteome? How does that relate to a metabolome?
Well, let me back up a little bit. I think just to remind people that really your health state is a combination of two things. It's a combination of your genome, meaning your genetic code, your DNA sequence, and also your environmental exposure. And we all know that intuitively, but what we don't know is what that means at a molecular level and how all this happens and how do we find signatures for these sorts of things. So the nice thing about omics, so omics is the study of large sets of things. So your genome is the study of all of your genes, if you will, and your whole DNA sequence. Your transcriptome is the study of all your RNA, your transcripts, and your proteome is the study of all your proteins. Your metabolome is the study of all your metabolites. And so the personal omics profiling, or omics collectively, means the study of all of those things together. Now, we're a believer that studying any one of these is nice, but studying all together is even much, much more powerful. You get a much clearer picture of what's going on. Rather than, as I say, with blood tests today, people typically measure 15 things or so. Now imagine you're studying 40,000 things at once. Sure. You just get a whole new level. It's like you're really looking at a level of detail no one's ever seen. So you can really see all of your pathways changing at any given time point. And I think that's the power of this personal omics profiling. You're seeing things at a much clearer picture than you would see otherwise.
It does make you the most omics man alive.
Well, that's not the goal, but that's I mean, I do put my information out there. It's all, you can download my genome, my proteome, my all of it yourself. And some people say, how can you do that? And my reaction is, I think it's great. People do look up my genome and they tell me things. I give seminars. I show my disease gene list. And some people come up and say, oh, you have such and such gene on your list. You might be aware of this or might want to watch out for that. And I welcome the free advice. I get thousands of free medical advice probably every week.
Somebody in the chat room just said, you can grow your own, Dr. Snyder.
Yeah. You can, actually.
Okay. Oh, wow. All right. Yes, I see that.
An augmented Snyder. A darker yeah. Snyder. You could augment. The augments should be voted against. What is, I hate to say, what's your favorite omic? I mean, I tend to think that I love the beauty of the genome, and it's the unchanged or very, it's the most stable chemistry in our body. But you know, the transcriptome is the genes that are turned on, right? And the interplay of 20,000 genes all active and playing around, I think is neat. But do you prefer proteomics? I mean, you've done a considerable amount of work on the proteomics side.
Yeah, well, I think they're all important. I know I probably sound like a politician, but they each tell you slightly different things. I think the genome is the base. I think we all need the genome as part of this. And so, but that really is just the starting point. It tells you what you're genetically predisposed towards. These other omes, they're all powerful. The transcriptome is really, really nice because you can follow all of your transcripts. And in my case, I'm following, you know, 20,000 transcripts at exquisite detail. There were some very interesting things we learned from that, by the way. And then there's also the proteome. The nice thing about the proteome and the metabolome is they're much closer to your phenotype, if you will. They're much closer to your health state because they're the products of your transcript. So they have a lot of power as well. To be honest, one reason I'm being political and saying they're all important is that we learn things by seeing all of these things together that we would not have learned by following one at a time, either the transcriptome or the proteome.
Out of that?
Well, we could see, this gets kind of scientifically astute, I suppose, so it might be tougher for the layperson, but you can actually see different cellular pathways going up and down at different times during my disease states. And my two main disease states are these viral infections I mentioned, where you can actually see what pathways are going up and down at what time. And then you also, I can follow what I call my normal state and my high glucose state, meaning when I had diabetes, or by the way, I'm still called diabetic. I'm just called managed diabetic now, even though I'm back to normal. But you can see the pathways that are elevated in my high glucose state relative to my low glucose state. And it's very fascinating to see those pathways. You can see that certain glucose regulation pathways spiked up and insulin response pathways spiked down. And some of those things, as I say, they're signatures that only popped out by following all of them together, that no one pathway, no one ohm would be able to tell me. And so by doing the meta-ohm, or what I call the IPOP, the integrated personal omics profile, is really was quite valuable for being able to get this picture.
So let's assume I'm Warren Buffett and I want to have this type of study done on myself. How much should I set aside?
Well, it literally costs us millions to set up because just buying all the equipment and setting this up. Sequencing a genome, if you do it the way normal people do it these days, it's about $3,500. Now, it costs us more because when we did mine, because it was a lot more expensive back then. But let's say you wanted to get an accurate genome. You could probably do it with two technologies and say do it for about $10,000 for a highly accurate clinical genome, I would argue, not sort of what people say, oh, yeah, we can sequence a genome for $3,500. That's not as accurate. So that's about $10,000, and you only have to do that once, right? It's not like your genome constantly changes. It may change a little bit. But then to do the omics profiling we did, once you have the equipment, it's about $2,500 in reagents, mostly for the transcriptome, a little bit for the proteome. But a lot of the stuff is fairly cheap. Now, the analysis costs a fortune because we had to have a team of scientists figure out how to analyze these data. It had never been done before. But now we have a framework where to do the next round isn't so expensive. So what does it cost us right now? I would say it's about $2,500, but it will drop dramatically and quite quickly, I think, tenfold, I would imagine, within a few years. And that's a guess. Nobody can predict this stuff with a lot of accuracy. But one thing I like to say is when we first tiled the whole human genome, it cost us $90,000 for one copy of the array that we used to do this, the technology we used to do it. 2 years later, you could do it much better for $2,000. I think that's what will happen with omics profiling, personal omics profiling. I think right now it's $2,500, and if you add the analysis, it's probably 10 times that. It's probably more like $25,000 or $30,000. But in the future, it really will become one-tenth and then ultimately 1/100th of that. I think you can do this stuff ultimately for the same price you pay for a blood test now, which is a few hundred dollars, by the way.
10 years from $1 billion genome to a $2,000 genome, or maybe even 10,000 if you want to do it several times and do the comparisons. How long will it take till the omic personal omic signatures or IPOP can be a reality in medicine?
Yeah, these timelines are hard to predict. It's important to emphasize right now, especially with the William Buffett comment, that this is still a research project. That is, we don't know what to make of all the data. We're still pouring through it. We want to understand in more detail. There's a lot of things we see go up and down that we don't know how to, and so we don't know how to interpret it. And so we really need several hundred more of these profiles for starters, ultimately thousands of profiles that will be very, very valuable. And then it may be in the future, I think it's likely in the future, that we don't have to follow all 40,000 things we did for me, that hopefully we could just follow a few thousand things, and that would be terrific. Now, one thing I'd like to say when this ultimately goes into the clinic or further, and this will be controversial, but I like the idea that this could be incredibly accessible in a simple home test. So, for example, right now, you probably know if you're a diabetic, they do a little pinprick. In fact, I even brought my glucose meter here. So you probably know you can have your own hand monitor. I'll hold this up if I can. I don't know if you can see that. Anyway, it's my glucose meter, and you do a little prick, and you get a tiny little drop of blood, and they measure your glucose level. I would like to see that set up so that you can measure 5,000 different things, not simply one. And you do it as a home test, exactly, and you would do it yourself, maybe once a month. And the reason that's controversial, some people will say, oh, that's terrible, but I don't think it would replace you going to the doctor. In fact, it would only help. What will happen is you would do this at home, and then when you see something that looks funny or might alert you, then you would make sure you go to the doctor right away, that there looks like there's something funny. These proteins or metabolites are suddenly increased, and maybe I better go get a more comprehensive checkup. Here's another problem, and I think a lesson that came out of my study, which is that I normally, as a healthy person, go to the doctor about every 2 or 3 years. And I think that's probably pretty typical. And because I was profiling myself, I actually caught this this high glucose increase, this onset of diabetes, right as it happened. And because of that, I could take corrective action, and it ultimately came down to normal. And the key for disease and health states is to catch diseases early. No matter what disease, if you catch it right away, you can almost do something, always do something about it. Whereas if you catch it late, there's damage that's been done, and it's very hard to correct that damage. Cancer is a good example. You catch cancer late, it's very, very hard to reverse it once it's metastasized. But the same is true for diabetes. It's thought that once it comes on late and a lot of other things, once it's caught late and detected late, by then you may already have organ failure. And in my case, if I had followed my normal plan, I really wouldn't have caught this diabetes till about a year from now, so roughly 18 to 20 months after I did, in fact, catch it. So I like the idea that you're constantly following your health profile with some simple tests, and then you can you would normally go, it wouldn't stop you from going to the doctor like you normally do to get your regular checkup, but it could augment that, and it could alert you to things right after they happen so that you can take corrective action.
I have a question, and I appreciate the type of science that this is, in that when I do drug discovery work, I have to put a mouse at risk to do my animal work, and I learn from the animal work, but boy, would it be nice to be able to work on humans. And but you know, it just doesn't make sense. Of course, you don't want to risk a human life, and you can't. Your work allows you to develop sort of a diagnostic and a medical tool by and work with humans at the same time, which I think is a fascinating way. It's always more fun when it's clinically relevant, every experiment you do. But let me ask you, have you learned anything? Every time you sequence a human genome and you start playing with it, there's going to be, especially with the team that you have an incredible team of folk that can really dig down into that. Have you learned something about the human genome, about the human condition, genetically speaking, that you didn't know before? It's not just your medical history, but did you learn something about the nature of humanity or our biology with this data?
Well, I think we have some new hints about things. So first of all, let me say that I do have an incredibly talented team that work with me. I'm really quite fortunate to have that, both some of my collaborators here, such as Carnie Do, Hua Tang, Mark Gerstein, you and Ashley Atul Butte, and Russ Altman in particular, as well as people in my lab, Rui Chen, George Mias, Jennifer Lee Pukton, and Li Hua Zhang, I want to mention, and Hugo Lam, who have been instrumental in the study. But what did we learn? Well, one thing fundamental we learned is that viral infections that are nasty can cause significant health issues. And I don't think that had been really well known, that diabetes can be triggered by a nasty viral infection. There's been evidence that stress responses trigger diabetes, but nothing like this. And so I think that's something that we now learn, but it's not proven because it's only been shown once. So we want to go out there and look at it now in lots of other cases to see whether this happens frequently. I suspect it does, because since our paper got published, I've been flooded with emails with people with similar circumstances. So probably like any good study, it raised more questions than it answered. But then we also see hints of other things like that are less certain. But this is where we need to profile lots and lots of people. So I will say that realistically, there will be millions of human genome sequences out there in a fairly short period of time. But if we don't have a million good medical records to go with that, we don't have a million good molecular phenotypes, they are fairly worthless. But if we do have that, if we have a million good medical records, and imagine a million good molecular profiles like mine to go with these million genome sequences, that's going to be a very, very powerful data set. I think it'll transform our understanding of human health and disease, and I think the whole world's going to benefit by it. And in fact, that was one of the motivations for the study, to really take things to a level that I think we should be at, where we're following, as they say, tens of thousands of things, ultimately millions of things I'd like us to follow. And so we really see everything that's changing. There are pathways that are changing that I don't understand in my profile, and I'll have a better idea when I see 100 people with the same signatures, molecular signatures that are changing, and that will be just very, very informative. And so I see this is all going to be research for right now, so that we can get hundreds of these profiles and hopefully find new signatures that'll tell us early markers of disease and when things are going wrong, and also help us understand what exactly is going wrong so we can treat them better. So, I could add one last thing if you want to hear a follow-up comment.
Yes.
Sure. Well, so think about diabetes. It's, why did everyone look at me and say, there's no way you have diabetes? And the reason is I don't fit the normal thoughts about what a diabetic person is. And as I've learned about diabetes, it's an incredibly heterogeneous disease, and realistically, it's probably hundreds of diseases all lumped together because these people just have high glucose. So it's probably really 100 diseases. Maybe it's hundreds, 500 diseases. We don't really know. And evidence of this is the fact that some people seem to respond to anti-inflammatory drugs. Some don't. Some respond to a drug called metformin. Some don't. People are responding very differently. There's a lot of people who actually are like me. They have a normal body mass index, who don't have diabetes. There are others who have high body mass index and get diabetes. That's a more typical form. So I think there are diabetes at the end of the day is going to be probably 100 diseases triggered many different ways. And therefore, if we really understand just how many diseases there are, how they got triggered, what's wrong in these different cases, and this is the essence of personalized medicine. If we understand what's wrong in that individual, we can treat that individual the way they should be treated, not just in a lump category. Gee, they've got diabetes. Let's give them metformin and see if they respond or not. Hopefully, we'd be able to say, oh, this person's going to respond to metformin. Let's give them just that drug. And same, this is very evident in the cancer field, by the way, where it's very evident you want to be zooming in on the exact changes that are there so you can target the disease and really target those defects specifically.
Well, I think this has been one of the most fascinating episodes we've ever made. And I think I'm going to stay true to form by asking a question that may be a little bit relevant, but have any of your students calculated your percentage of Neanderthal genes?
Well, we did it for the markers. We should have done it for the whole genome. And I came out, when we did a genotyping array, I came out on the high end. I had something like 8 or 9 markers, as did a few others. And I'm happy to say most of my students were less than me. So that's probably a good thing.
It's fantastic. Yeah. You know, it's been a real honor to have you on the show. And to, you know, one of the missions of the show is to create a firsthand account of the great work done in labs around the country. And this is an opportunity for us to have that first look at you know, that study and get it straight, get the story from you. And I kind of see this as a paradigm shift in medicine, being able to have an omic signature, a comprehensive omic signature. And today, when that paper came out, you know, medicine changed. And even though it's not available yet to everyone, and it's perhaps only to one, as you said, the cost is going down. So that was the time when people started, for example, just using a telephone instead of you know, it was that this level of paradigm shift. So I'm really honored that you agreed to be on the show and to talk to us today. So thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. No, it's been great to be here. And this project has been a lot of fun. And to be honest, that's one of the reasons we did it. We thought it would be fun.
It's a great motivation. Fun is always a great motivation. Our guest today was Dr. Michael Snyder. He was he is chair of Department of Genetics at Stanford School of Medicine. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Mark and Andre. So,
also, I'd like to thank Andre Nantel. He is senior research officer at the Biotechnology Research Institute at the National Research Council of Canada. Thank you, Andre, for coming on and helping out with this.
Thank you, Mark.
Tsunami science. This is not trickle down science or, you know, single gene reductionist science. This is.
I don't remember the last time we fought each other for questions like that. That was a lot of fun.
Well, we were both reading the paper late last night, or rereading the paper, because of course the paper that was published was that paradigm shifting science stuff, and those come around maybe once every 10 years. So knock on wood. I'd also like to thank Dr. Mark Gerstein for helping coordinate the show. And so thank you, Mark Gerstein. He's a regular on the show as well. He's been a guest a number of times and a co-host and panelist. I'd like to also thank Sarah Chirico for helping with the audio and sound checks and the audiovisual work. And for her patience dealing with those headsets. I'd also like to thank Liz Romero for handling the audio and video boards today and recording, and Jeff and his team for doing the editing. I'd also like to thank our chief twit, Leo Laporte, and the entire crew at the Brick House for making this possible. By the way, Dr. Snyder, if you'd like a high-profile omic signature, Leo Laporte is always... We asked Dr. Church to get his genome sequenced a number of times for the large-scale genomics projects, but he's a great communicator and a highly technical one.
Oh, doing so Leo would be awesome.
He's got a million followers that will pay attention. So if you want to make a quick transition to getting...
You're suggesting to do a personal omics profile on him, is that right?
when you start scaling, he's the guy. He's syndicated on 60 to 100 national radio shows, radio stations cross country, and talks technology. His motto is everything on a chip, and her slogan. And as a matter of fact, we had you as potentially on our shortlist for the first ever Futures in Biotech. And you were very, very busy, and you're one of your postdocs that went on to do a become a professor at Johns Hopkins came on for that pilot show. It didn't air, but maybe it was a good thing that we saved you for episode 93. Thanks for coming on. But if you need somebody who can help communicate the story, he'd be a great OMIC signature. And he's
French great.
So I'd like to know a little bit about what his
great suggestion. I'll take you up on that.
All right. And I'd like to let people know that if you have any comments or suggestions, I can be reached at Mark, M-A-R-C, at twit.tv, or on Twitter at Mark Pelletier, M-A-R-C-P-L-L-E-T-I-E-R. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelletier.